right, everyone. I am actually not feeling well. First time I've had this kind of a sort of chest cold, head cold, since a year before Marty died. It's been that long.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I don't get sick like this, you know. But anyway, so I'm getting sick, which is maybe you know what it is? It's everything that we're covering. I mean, I feel like our world is falling apart. So of course, I would have to fall apart too. I mean, it's like I'm the echo chamber of what's happening to democracy. If democracy is fraying at the edges, so is Arnie Arneson. All right, everyone, it is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and of course, Ken Barnes is our producer. It is Wednesday, December 18th. They're voting on the articles of impeachment as we speak.
Or at least they're debating them.
They're debating them, yeah, debating them. Well, it'll be a long day. It might end up being voted on tomorrow. But I don't know if you – did you see what I put in for today? I decided that I was going to dedicate today to the letter I.
Yeah.
And it had to be more than just impeachment. And I went through this whole list of stuff. And then after I listed all these things, Jill Schaefer Hammond said, I've got some. And then she added to my list, intensely insidious, idiotic, ideologue. That was her addition. But it was my Sesame Street day for the letter I and this interesting president. And it's actually even hard for me to say president, I have to admit. It's very hard because there's just no level of – he doesn't – it's
presidentiality?
About, no. It's he's so selfish. That's the part that kills me. Mm. He's so selfish. It's all about him. And when you think you're electing someone – and if someone said, well, he was elected to sort of tear down the place. But you don't tear down the place and then make yourself the exalted king. That isn't what people were expecting. They didn't expect, you know, him to destroy all the sort of checks and balances and then make himself the despot. That was not in the plan. And that's really what he wants to do because that's the only thing he knows how to do. He doesn't know how to work nice in the sandbox. He only knows how to shake people down. And now he's shaking us all down, not just the Ukrainians. Anyway, on that note, Ken Barnes, where are you going?
I'm going to talk about an article in the Washington Monthly by Sidney Blumenthal entitled The Emergence of Abraham Lincoln. And it is really interesting how much Abraham Lincoln in his times relates to the present time, except, of course, we don't have an Abraham Lincoln, but
right.
Other than that, the times were pretty similar. You were talking about democracy and chaos here. It was pretty chaotic back in the day when Lincoln was around also.
They wanted to secede. Talk about chaotic. In some ways, Donald Trump is actually sort of fueling secession, a variation on the theme, but it feels very much like that, that they want to leave.
Yeah, and Southern nullification. I mean, he's nullifying all the laws and constitutional provisions that he can. So this article begins, it's always important to know about Lincoln, and today it is urgent. As Lincoln said in his House Divided speech, if we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could then better judge what to do and how to do it. The House Divided, the incitement of demagogues, appeals to anti-immigrant nativism and racism, a reactionary Supreme Court, a dysfunctional presidency, and the breakup of the old parties – all of these Lincoln confronted in his rise to the presidency. So how similar is that to today? It's really interesting. No one else in the crisis combined Lincoln's political skill, his force of logic and argument, his sense of when to step forward and when not to step forward prematurely, the clarity of his principles, and his subtlety and practicality in achieving them. At every step of his way, in order to destroy the greatest concentration of wealth and political power in the country, which was slavery's power, he had to create new instruments of power, whether it's the Illinois Republican Party to the Union Army.
Right.
Through his leadership, he had to summon, quote, all the powers of earth, unquote, to save democracy and overthrow slavery. Lincoln begins in virtual obscurity, forgotten after one term in the Congress. He was roaming county courthouse to courthouse in the 8th Judicial District of Central Illinois in the company of an entourage of traveling lawyers, kind of like an itinerant troupe of Victorian Shakespearean actors.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln is mainly pressing the claims of small debt collectors or defending against them, studying Euclid's geometry at night by candlelight. And suddenly the crisis begins. In 1854, he was, as he said, aroused as he had never been aroused before. His perpetual rival since he had entered Illinois politics, Senator Stephen A. Douglas, a master demagogue, who envisioned himself as the living spirit of the age, desperate to win the Democratic presidential nomination, wanted the credit for sponsoring the first transcontinental railroad, which would have to be constructed across the territory of the Great Plains. And the Great Plains was not yet organized into states. So Douglas cut the deal in the Kansas-Nebraska Act with the great southern beasts of the Congress and good old New Hampshire President Franklin Pierce to erase the Missouri Compromise, which had prohibited slavery above a certain northern latitude. So Douglas had negotiated with the Southerners mm-hmm. to do away with the Missouri Compromise and allow slavery back as a deal so that he could build the Transcontinental Railroad.
He needed those Southern boys.
Yeah. So whether the territories and eventually states would be free or slave, said Douglas, would be up to the settlers. They could have slavery if they wanted. He called it popular sovereignty. Douglas believed his calculated indifference to slavery squared a political circle. Instead, his plan set off
–
Instead, his plan set off –
Arnie, wash your mouth out. Yeah.
His plan set off the mini Civil War called Bleeding Kansas, which I remember from the history books. But, that's a stretch to dig up what that was.
Yeah.
So Lincoln still thought of himself as a member of the Whig Party, which had split North and South with a sizable section drifting into the anti-immigrant Know-Nothing Party, also known as the American Party. It sounds like the Know-Nothing Party exists today. That party's platform demanded that only native-born Protestants should hold public office.
Oh, God, Trump would so love this.
Forget about you,
oh
Catholics
don't tell him. He'll put it in the next tweet.
Lincoln didn't join the Republican Party at first. It was not yet a party. The people calling themselves Republicans in 1854 in Illinois were a small group of radical abolitionists. The Free Soil Party, a broader anti-slavery organization than those calling themselves Republicans, had attracted 6% of the vote in Illinois in the previous presidential election of 1852. But eventually, Lincoln moved towards the Republicans and got himself elected. But it was really coming from a position of crisis in 1854 when he was a totally obscure nobody, a former congressman has been. And this outrageous deal, Kansas-Nebraska Acts were passed, and the deal was to maintain slavery in the new states in America in exchange for Stephen Douglas aggrandizing his own personal needs,
success.
Sort of like a president that we have today.
Exactly.
So
everything was expendable.
There were no
values.
Yeah.
Just the win.
Yeah, there's a lot more to the story, but I just was struck by the way we think now, Arnie, that we're living in this crisis and chaos and everything's so impossible.
Yeah.
And it was exactly the same when Lincoln grew from obscurity to be the great president that he was.
What do they say? History doesn't repeat, but it definitely rhymes.
It rhymes.
I also, just to let you know, I posted on Facebook how you can listen to what's going on today in Washington with the House of Representatives online. So there's a link to that. So you can still listen to the radio rather than having to turn to a different radio station. You can listen online and make that sort of your background noise and continue to listen to the radio. And I'm here to help. I'm not sure that's helpful, but I figured I needed to help. So we're really not going to be talking about impeachment. That's maybe a conversation for tomorrow. And that's been a conversation for so long. And I'm not sure what kind of added value that we can sort of contribute. So we have to talk about other things. And this is going to sound like a rather stretch. And it's by a professor who wrote at theconversation.com. And her article was 7 Reasons to Learn a Foreign Language. And actually, she gave a TED Talk. I was looking at her bio. And she had given a TED Talk. And her TED Talk is about the U.S. foreign language deficit. And part of the reason why I really wanted to do this is that I go back to my childhood. You know, I'm half Norwegian and half Italian. My Norwegian grandmother came over very, very young. Her father lost his wife in a field in Norway, and he was a seaman, so he put his two children on the boat, and he was always going back and forth to Brooklyn, New York. At about age two or three, my grandmother arrived in Brooklyn, and the story I'm told is that she had two dresses, and she went from one Norwegian family to another Norwegian family, but that the only language she really knew was English. My Italian grandparents, however, English was a struggle. They did not know English. And as a child, my mother had me go across the street so my grandparents could take care of me, because my mother went back to work literally within, I think, hours of my birth. She didn't like me. Anyway, but any excuse to get away. But I remember the discussion in my Italian grandparents' family about the fact that they were afraid to talk Italian around me because they wanted me to be an American. And the idea of having a second language or being fluent in Italian to them was a sign of weakness. And therefore, I had to – they, even though I knew they were talking in Italian and I could say, buongiorno, come stai, io sto bene, you know, a little bit. But they would almost wash my mouth out with soap because they wanted me to speak English because it was too important to them, because that was about assimilation. They wanted to be an American, All right? And I have such regrets that they didn't understand that they could have given me so much more. And I still would have been an American, because we are this incredibly interesting melting pot. We come from very different places. But the idea of having another language as part of my skill set was something that till this day I regret. And what is so interesting is that my daughter is an ESL teacher today, and my daughter teaches in Shanghai. And virtually every single child in China is learning a second language. And what is that language? English. And you know what's so remarkable, Ken? Those kids know English and English grammar than most elementary school kids do. We're talking like a 7-year-old from her school learning English and a 7-year-old at the elementary school across the street. My daughter was distraught. Her 7-year-olds, where English was their second language, were more proficient, were more grammatically correct, and had a huge vocabulary compared to the 7-year-olds, because she tried to do an exchange program. So again, the idea of learning languages, I think, is so important. So Now I get to bring in my guest who's sitting here going, okay, that was a great soliloquy. Dr. Kathleen Stein-Smith wrote this piece, 7 Reasons to Learn a Foreign Language. She is an adjunct faculty at Fairleigh Dickinson University, editor of the blog Language Matters, and I want to welcome her to the program. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me on today. I really look forward to our conversation. So, this is such an important topic, and I can hear from the way that you speak, it's important to you and also near to your heart.
Oh, in every way. So you wrote 7 reasons why learning a foreign language is a benefit. And then you also sent us to a site that actually sort of talks, it calls leadwithlanguages.org, and they give 10 reasons to learn a language. But let's start with why learning a language is such an enhancer. It is not something to be run away from. It is not something that depletes our IQ. It is something that really, I think, it not only enhances our ability to understand different cultures, but that it really does, I think, even make us stronger mentally, because we're able to go back and forth in 2 different languages, and that's an incredible skill set, and it's a skill set that actually makes us stronger and smarter.
You know, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and certainly while the article is entitled 7 Reasons to Learn Another Language, and another website may have 10, there really are an infinite number of reasons to learn other languages, really as varied as the individuals who learn them. But I think importantly, we need to think about the benefit to the individual, the benefit to the individual in the workplace, and by extension, to our economy. But then also we need to think about ourselves really on the global stage.
Yes.
Multilingualism is not only part of the process really of developing a global mindset, but it's also a tool that you use to work with others to address all of these very complex global issues that we face today.
Well, you gave a TED talk about the language deficit. And let me just say something. So I grew up in a very blue-collar neighborhood on Long Island, Hicksville, New York. I graduated in 1971, so you can do the math going back. Do you know when I started taking languages? When I was 5 years old. When I was five, they started they started offering us French, okay? That no longer exists in my school system on Long Island. That doesn't exist in many school systems around the country. But isn't it fascinating that one of the, that this blue collar, you know, up they these were all sort of first generation Americans that were really going to school with me, and they really wanted their kids to have this wealth of knowledge. And one of the definitions of wealth of knowledge was that even at age 5 or 6, they started giving us at least some sort of appetite for languages. And that is actually a foreign concept today, but yet back then it was something that they actually saw was so critical.
You know, I think you raise a very good point. You know, as globalization really has brought us all closer together, and certainly advances in telecommunications enable us to communicate with a much broader group of people around the world. At the same time, availability of foreign languages, you mentioned that a program that you were part of here in Long Island no longer exists. But that's not just in one particular school district. Mm-hmm. Foreign languages are offered in fewer elementary and middle schools than they were.
Right.
And now, in addition to that, though, I'm sorry.
Keep going.
But it's, you know, just as the need has become greater, the availability has become less, and it's actually now starting to be exacerbated by the fact that we're actually now also, in a sense, missing a generation of foreign language teachers. There's a well-documented teacher shortage of foreign language, second language, immersion language teachers.
So let me just say something. I want choice in school, and I don't mean charters. I want the choice that I see at St. Paul's, at Choate, at all these fancy Phillips Exeter. Because when you look at those schools, guess what they offer? Every kind of possible language. They offer Chinese. They offer Greek. They offer Latin. They offer French. All right. They offer just a wealth of them. They offer philosophy. They offer all kinds of art. They offer all kinds of dance. And what you're telling me is what's making me so frightened. And that is that we talk about inequality. And inequality, we usually think about, you know, wealth. And that's how we think. Well, there's a wealth of knowledge inequality that we are actually encouraging. Because if we are seeing fewer and fewer schools offering language as an option for public school, and we are seeing the elite going to these, you know, very prestigious schools, and they are being massaged in language, massaged in philosophy, you know, one of the things that you write about is that, you know, knowing other languages advances your career. Well, screw it. Who's getting advanced and who's getting left behind starting at 5?
You know, I think the equity issue is an important one. And I know before you really alluded to the fact that parents play a critical role in local educational decisions and, by extension, the availability of foreign language, early foreign language, and foreign language immersion programs. But, you know, it's interesting. And the question of equity. Traditionally, in the U.S., we are really a nation of immigrants.
Right.
And actually, in the 19th century into the early 20th century, bilingual education in public school, well, in schools, was not so rare. And then just due to events in the 20th century, it became really much rarer in public schools.
Right.
And according to the America's Languages Report, that trend is continuing. And just while research shows that although you can learn a language at any age, early exposure is obviously best in terms of learning, but also in terms of the time that you can spend on the language.
Right.
Learning a language is not an overnight project.
Right. Well, you know, it's so interesting because I think that the one of the things I saw in one of the sites that you sent me to was the idea that now instead of language, computer language is being used as an alternative to French or Urdu or Italian or Chinese. And that is the alternative, as if that's an alternative. And you know why that makes me so angry? I tell this story all the time, and that is I heard a guy who won, like, the High Tech Council of the Year award. It was an event that happened maybe 15 years ago. And they asked him, you know, what did he attribute his knowledge of being able to write these codes and why he was able to be so successful with his company? And he said, ask me what my major was. And everybody said, okay, what's your major? He said
it was French.
Romance languages.
Okay,
romance languages. There you go. And he said it taught me to think and hear differently. Think
you
about
know,
that. Oh my God.
That's an absolutely wonderful story. That's a great story, and it's true.
Yeah.
You know, this whole question of coding versus languages
right.
is really a false question.
Yes.
It really shouldn't be either or. Because our young people, our children need both.
Yeah.
They certainly need to have computer skills, and they certainly need to have language skills. And importantly, you raised the point that this needs to really happen in our public schools.
It has to.
You know, it needs to be, language instruction needs to be available to all our children. And the place where it's available to all our children is the American public school. And, you know, the good news is, though, now in the New York area, for example, there's been an initiative that's been called the Bilingual Revolution
okay.
in New York City public
okay.
schools.
Okay.
And there are immersion programs in New York City public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Now I believe they are at a dozen languages.
Wow. Wow.
And I think that is really, and it's not just in New York City. There are public school immersion programs in other parts of the country. I've heard about Utah, Delaware. I've even heard talk, I was fortunate last year to have been invited to speak at the NALT conference.
Now, what's that?
Well, that's the New Hampshire Association of World Language Teachers.
Really? I didn't even know we had such a thing. Now, and I live in New Hampshire. I'm mortified. Okay, keep going.
Well, I do not live in New Hampshire, yeah. but I was fortunate enough to be invited really? There in 2018
yep.
to speak about world language advocacy.
Yep.
And I know I was really so encouraged by really the dedicated, very professional world language educators that I was able to talk mm-hmm. with, interact
mm-hmm.
with
mm-hmm.
at the conference. And one of the things that I heard a lot about was immersion in public schools, immersion programs.
Right.
And, you know, that is, the research says that immersion, starting at the elementary level or even the preschool level, is the methodology most likely to lead to a successful learning outcome.
And, you know, and not just learning outcome in the language, learning outcome. It's kind of like music and what it does for making you skilled at math. There are these amazing connections. You know, we want to talk about STEM, but we don't want to talk about foreign language and we don't want to talk about music. And then we find out that the violinist is really skilled in math. Or we find out mm-hmm. that person who has these multiple languages has actually not only expanded their mind, expanded their career opportunities, can now communicate with different cultures, but has opened so many more doors than the kid who is only, you know, with one language. And
you know, absolutely. The research that is really coming out of neuroscience is mind-boggling. Multilingualism or bilingualism have been linked to creativity,
right.
Problem-solving, better reasoning ability, to our ability to adjust to changing and ambiguous situations. You know, it is amazing. They're not really separate silos.
No.
When we're developing, in a sense, brain fitness, we're exercising our brains. We're developing those abilities.
And so let me just say something. Go on, Ken. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say one other thing that you haven't touched upon is the other effect of learning languages, and especially learning them fluently through immersion, is people. Foreign languages enable you to relate
yes.
to people
the
from other cultures.
The immigration problem is something that we could actually change by knowing a language.
Yeah,
think
but
about
not
that.
Just the immigration problem. When I read about Europe now
yeah.
and the news in Europe, I understand because I've taken a couple of language courses in
right.
French and Spanish, and
mm-hmm.
I have a feeling for the people and the
right.
culture, and also when you go visit them, you don't just go to the tourist attractions with some guide who speaks English.
Right.
You can actually talk to human beings
right.
and, you know, share some of the culture, and you're on some kind of equal level where you understand each other human to human.
Well, let me just say something, and I need to let you go, but so I mentioned that my daughter is an ESL teacher in Shanghai. I want to give you a little bit of a window in. They didn't want her to learn Chinese. They only wanted her to speak in English because they were afraid that she would slip into Chinese. And she suddenly realized it was a control thing. they wanted their students to be able to speak Chinese and English, but they wanted the ESL teacher to basically be limited, you know, in this little confine of English only. Well, my daughter had to literally leave school to teach. She stopped it just so she could take these courses in Chinese because she suddenly realized she needed to be able to have conversations with these kids' parents. She needed to have conversations mm-hmm. with her now husband who's Chinese. She needed to be able to talk to people at the grocery store. And by isolating her, by insisting that she not learn Chinese while she was teaching these kids, it was a very interesting control. It was about control.
Speaking languages, though, it really transforms your life. As Ken just said, you can travel, you can have interactions with people that you would not be able to have if you were limited to English. You can have access to media.
Yeah.
You can hear what people are saying about what's going on in their own countries in their language. You know, if you listen to American media and then maybe you listen to French media, some of the stories are the same. The perspectives may be different, stories may be the same, mm-hmm. but then there are entirely different stories that you will hear in global media that they're not on our radar. We don't hear them in our national media.
Right.
So it does broaden your perspective.
And I need to let you go. Kathleen Stein
Smith. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I am so, and I just want everyone to know, I have been honored by the government of France and named a Chevalier dans l'Ordre des Palmes Académiques, and I serve as chair of AATF, Commission on Advocacy. And obviously, this is a passion for you. You've delivered TED Talks about it. It is a passion for me because as the world is shrinking, what is more important than just the social media aspect of it is that we really are able to communicate. And communicating isn't about like typing. Communicating is about speaking. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this opportunity, and I really want to thank you and your team for helping to get the word out about this important topic, for all of us, our children and the parents of children.
Thank you so much. Ciao.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day that Congress passed the 18th Amendment, which outlawed the transportation, manufacture, and sale of alcohol. The amendment went into effect 13 months later. According to John Rumbarger, author of Profits, Power, and Prohibition, the temperance movement centered on tightening social control of working people. Workers often met in bars and saloons to unwind after work and to socialize. But in the days before union halls, the saloon also doubled as a headquarters where workers could talk about problems on the job, like mistreatment and poor working conditions. They used the saloon as a place to plan and organize strikes. It also served as a site for workers to talk politics and organize around political parties. Many prominent industrialists complained that saloons were breeding grounds for labor unrest and radical politics. They also feared a growing immigrant working class that tied its fate to powerful political machines like those in Chicago, New York, and Boston. The anti-saloon movement brought a strange mix into its coalition. It included the KKK, who worried of the growing power of immigrant workers. But it also included progressives, who worked for labor harmony and sobriety as a means of public health. The anti-saloon movement also targeted German brewers. The United States had just entered World War I, and anti-German sentiment was so high that many considered German breweries to be working for the Kaiser, their product a sap on the energy of servicemen and grain production to feed the U.S. troops. But alcohol flowed freely throughout the 1920s, creating both the jazz speakeasy and bootlegging syndicates. It would ultimately be repealed by 1933.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. There's a lot of bad news out there about global warming, and it can make people feel afraid or sad about how the Earth is changing. But Ethnology, a social science think tank, John Fraser is studying hope. Fraser is a conservation psychologist, and he says feelings of fear can cause people to disengage from the issue of climate change.
They tend to lead people to draw inward. They tend to cause people to limit what they're saying to try to minimize the pain, minimize the concern. And that can be self-destructive.
Fraser says that it's important to create supportive communities where people can acknowledge and process their difficult feelings and then refocus their attention on action. He says when people have an opportunity to come together and focus on solutions to the climate crisis,
we see a rise in hope. Hope is the belief that I can accomplish a goal that may seem insurmountable. So it's targeted, it's specific, and it isn't necessarily Pollyanna happiness. What hope is a targeted way of seeing my future and taking the steps to get to that future.
So cultivating hope is not only better for people's mental health. Fraser says it can also motivate climate action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This land is your land.
This land is made for you and me. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And I don't know if you remember who sings
that
this.
That is Sharon Jones.
You got it. You got it. So, you know, we're going to be talking about Amy Klobuchar. And I think of Minnesota, and I just need to remind everyone, I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. I worked at the IDS building where you see Mary Tyler Moore throw her hat up in the air. I rented an apartment that said Mary Tyler Moore wanted to live here, right on Loring Park. And I rented the apartment, and I sent my mother a note, and I said, but Rhoda moved in. And then I went, actually, I spent a couple of years working for a law firm, Daugherty, Rumble & Butler, in the Twin Cities. I, believe it or not, it was a corporate law firm. And I got nervous because I couldn't handle it.
You and Elizabeth Warren.
Me, exactly. Me and Mayor Pete. Look at McKinsey. I mean, think about this. It was my first job, you know, out of school. And let me just say something before I grab Walter Shapiro, who's probably going to go, oh, my God, now what? Anyway, because you also wrote a piece about Mayor Pete. So I also want to talk both about Amy and about Mayor Pete. But let me just share something with you. I was on my way to divinity school. Okay, I was a religion major and a political science major and an urban affairs major when I was at St. Olaf. I decided at the last minute after having worked for a church in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that maybe the collar wasn't for me. Okay. Now, remember, I'm on my way thinking I'm going to be a minister. So my mother, I get a job offer from the nonprofit that I'm working for, and they're offered to pay for my master's in social work at the University of Wisconsin. I was ecstatic. Okay. And I call my mother up and go, this is incredible. They love me. I can get my master's. They want to hire me. This is who I am. Right. Here's what my mother says. This is to show you how come I ended up working for Daugherty, Rumble & Butler. My mother said to me, stop slumming it. And come home. All right?
Oh.
All right. This is my mother. And what did she do? She said, I have $1,000 for your graduation present, but we've spent it already. I said, really? And what have we spent it on? We decided that you have rejected law school, but maybe you should experience the law first. So they signed me up for corporate and securities paralegal school at Adelphi. Oh, shut up, Walter. At Adelphi University. And that's how I started. Did I make that choice? No, I was a dutiful daughter. What was my skill set? You know, 10Ks, Rule 146s, taking companies public, Blue Sky and corporations. Right. What did I know? And I ended up – and I couldn't do it. I mean, I fit, but I didn't fit, you know? So as I think about Elizabeth Warren and I think about Mayor Pete, a lot of these things are made – sort of not because you totally control it, but because, you know, there's an expectation that this is the definition of success. Being a social worker is not the definition of success. Being a poverty lawyer is not the definition of success. But on that note, Walter Shapiro, who's covered 11 campaigns for president in his long, long esteemed career, you wrote about one of those individuals that's running for president who's actually still on the debate stage. Well, there's a slim pickings. Mm. And her name is Amy Klobuchar, and that's where the Minnesota stuff comes in. And your question was, does Amy Klobuchar have a path to the nomination? The Minnesota senator is pitching herself as more electable, funnier alternative to the other moderates in the race. Let me welcome Walter Shapiro, who is covering his 11th, as I mentioned, presidential campaign, a staff writer at the New Republic, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and a lecturer of political science at Yale. I'm exhausted. How do you have time? Anyway, welcome to the program, Walter.
Oh, thank you, Arnie. It's always a pleasure. And I just want to say that after 11 presidential races, I just dream, just by luck, of getting one right.
Yeah. No. Listen, at this point, I don't think anyone can predict what's going to happen to this time. Everyone keeps asking me what's electable. And I looked at them. I said, electable in maybe even a sort of normal time, I might be able to give you a definition of that. But electable against someone who lies 24/7, who has no sense of policy, who will literally do anything because that's how he's operated his entire time when he was in New York in order to be successful. And that means trashing everyone around him. How do you define electable when this is what you're running against? And that's why Amy Klobuchar is interesting, because how do you see Amy as being able to operate in this toxic, lying swamp that defines Donald Trump?
Okay, let me back up. Okay. Number one, I want to say that I've only seen Klobuchar in Iowa.
Okay.
Other than at the state convention. Mm-hmm. I have not seen her in New Hampshire.
I have.
So this is more of an Iowa-centric view, which I always advance with nervousness when I'm on the radio in New Hampshire.
Well, and because Iowa is a suburb of Minnesota.
Northern Iowa.
Northern Iowa, especially. Yes, yes. Okay, keep going. So
anyway, my whole point is that she is running by the process of elimination. It's almost a Goldilocks. She's about halfway in age between Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah.
She is on the debate stage. Yeah. Unlike other senators like Cory Booker, she never had to announce, unless I raise $1 million in the next 9 minutes, I'm going to have to drop out.
Mm-hmm.
She has made every debate cut.
Mm-hmm.
In Iowa, depending on the poll, and I'm really nervous about citing any polls from Iowa because nobody knows how many people are going to caucus.
Mm-hmm.
She's running between 5 and 10 points.
Right.
Percentage, which, given how volatile Iowa is not a terrible place to be.
No,
John Edwards and John Kerry, at this point in 2003, had 22% support between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
On caucus night, with Kerry first and Edwards second, they had 70% of the caucus vote.
Wow.
And that basically, yes, she would love to have more money. But roughly after every good debate performance, she brings in about $2 million online.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point is, unlike other underdog candidates, just picking one who beat expectations in Iowa and then swept New Hampshire, a fellow by the name of Gary Hart in 1984.
Right.
These days, Hart had to wait for the checks to arrive in the mail.
God, that's right.
And then for the checks to clear.
That's right. That's right. How seamless is it today? You know, push so, the I donate
mean,
button.
I mean, the fact is the greatest right. publicity you
Very
could
good
have
point.
Being the upset winner of New Hampshire, there was a week's delay before we knew how much money it would bring in.
Wow. If
she came close in Iowa, she would know in the next 12 hours how much money she brought in. But much more importantly, going back to the idea of if you're looking for someone who's electable,
mm-hmm.
you can make a case that, number one, there is a hunger in the Democratic Party to achieve what Hillary Clinton failed
right.
to do in 2016.
A female nominee, exactly.
Which is to elect a woman president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can also make a case that after running an almost flawless campaign from the DNA test to about 6 weeks ago, Elizabeth Warren has stumbled very badly.
Right.
At least in perception. And again, I hate citing them in poll numbers. By number one, going too, in the thoughts of many, going too extreme on Medicare for All, and then backing away from it by saying, I'll only introduce legislation in my third year of my presidency.
She pulled a little bit of a Kamala Harris. Kamala did the same thing, because when Kamala came out first with Medicare for All, and then she kind of mumbled, and then she kind of like reconfigured, that didn't help Kamala, i.e. she's no longer in the race. But that was a stumbling block for her as well.
Yeah, but in the case of Elizabeth Warren, it's more acute because her whole calling card
yeah.
was she was an accidental senator.
Yeah.
That this is someone who never set out to yeah. check all the boxes on the road to success.
Right.
That her life story was really appealing because it was two steps forward, one and a half steps back.
Yeah.
And suddenly, on Medicare for All and this transition period, she is acting like a politician.
Well, let me just say something. You know, I mean, and I've been a single payer baby for a long time. Okay, I mean, I ran on that practically in 1992, and I ran for governor. But I've always understood, and one of the rationales for what I did in 92, Walter, was that I wanted the country to be able to experiment. I wanted to create something called tri-state care, where Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont would look at creating some kind of a single-payer system, and that they would be released from some of the burdens and expectations of Medicaid and Medicare, but they would be given those dollars. And then we could experiment with our hospitals that are, you know, really some most successful hospitals in the country are actually in those three states. We would have enough of a financial base as well as a population base to do it. But I wanted it as an experiment. I wanted to show that it could work because I had looked at what had happened in the Canadian example, where Canada did it province by province. What is so shocking to me, Walter, is these are really smart people. Why didn't Elizabeth Warren use the example of virtually every other country in the world that has a better healthcare system than us? None of them, no matter what Bernie Sanders says, and I love you, Bernie, is that none of them turned a switch and had everybody go on the program immediately. No one. No one. And they don't have the same kind of controls that the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry has over Congress. So what she did, I think, by becoming sort of Bernie, but then realizing in a more rational way that this is really the honest approach, she looked like she flipped because she hadn't said it right out of the box.
Somehow, while you were talking and making this point, which I agree with Arnie, I was remembering a video I saw of the day, photographs of the day in 1976 when Sweden overnight went from driving on the left to driving on the right.
Right.
And the pictures of confused drivers,
right.
which I maybe saw on the web 5 years ago,
wow.
stay with me. And it is a wrenching change causes accidents.
Yeah.
And I hope they had Medicare for all.
They did, I suspect. That's right. All right, you got hit. It's okay. You have no insurance. Not a problem. We cover you for that. But you're absolutely right. That was traumatic. But this in a more bizarre way is more from going from left to right. It's about all the people that are so vested in the current system because it's making so much money for them, and they employ so many people, and they control so many politicians. I don't know how many politicians were controlled when you changed the direction of how people drove in Sweden.
Oh, no, I agree. It was an imperfect metaphor.
Yeah, I know.
And I certainly hadn't thought about the ideological efforts of going from the left to the right.
Yeah, exactly.
But the larger point here, and something Klobuchar keeps saying, that who supports a robust public option, is it's a real mistake to tell in an election that you have to win. To tell 149 million Americans that they will lose their health insurance
right. For
something that they don't know what it will be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even now, with Medicare, what seems to be forgotten in this debate is anyone with who is affluent has a supplemental policy
exactly. On
top of Medicare.
Exactly. It doesn't cover
everything. You're not caught in the bureaucratic rigidity of Medicare rules.
And let's also be honest, I don't have control over my insurance or my doctor. My employer does. And my employer tomorrow could say, oh, nope, we're going to change plans. Oh, nope, you're in this network. Oh, no. So I have no control. The idea that I'm going to be losing control is garbage. Walter, nobody says that. You're not in control. The person who's in control is who your employer is working with as a consultant to say, okay, how do I make him less expensive? How do I pass more on to my employees? And then I just saw a story the other day. Do you know what they just did in the budget? Donald Trump in his budget just reduced the amount of Medicaid going to Puerto Rico.
By half.
So look at this. They're using health care as a threat to Puerto Rico because they didn't heal. When you use this, you are murdering people. I'm sorry. Cutting Medicaid by half is a death sentence. And, you know, we're all talking about the Ukraine. I would be impeaching him for the Medicaid thing because that's really what – but look what we're doing. We're using health care as a weapon. Oh, my God.
Can I just add that – in addition to your employer having more control than the employee does over your health care, it's also the insurance companies that have the control right. To change what they're offering for health plans.
Exactly.
And the employer only gets to choose what the insurance companies show him are the options. Okay. And often those options get worse and worse every year. The cost of the premiums go up for the employer and the employee. The amount of the deductible goes up every year. It just gets worse and worse.
So how does Amy get challenged by those questions? I mean, you've seen her in Iowa. I've seen her in
New Hampshire. I've seen her in Iowa.
Yeah. I mean, I know what she's saying, and it does sound reasonable, this sort of aggressive public option, nonprofit, yada, yada, and that most people might sort of want to be in that plan because it offers more. My fear is that you know what's going to happen. The insurance company is going to offer Cadillac plans to really healthy people, and then all the healthy people are going to be in their private plans, and the sicker and sicker people are going to exercise the public option, which is what we already do. We already take care of the old, 65 and older. We already take care of the poor and the sick, Medicaid. Now we're going to have a public option, and anybody that's got any kind of an illness, we're going to be covering. So government screws itself, Walter. We let insurance companies make out like a bandit because they can cherry pick, and then we say, oh, no, we'll take the rest of you. But the rest of you bankrupts the system.
Let me make a counter here,
okay,
Arnie, which is without defending insurance companies,
defending
the status quo,
yes, sir.
We're also living in a world of realism.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that even if the Democrats, knock wood, win the White House in 2020, even if knock wood a couple of times, they might have a one-vote Senate majority.
Yes.
Which is an optimistic read on states like Maine, particularly, and North Carolina.
Susan's running again. She announced this morning, everyone, Susan Collins. So, yep, we'll see.
But even if that's the case, the votes aren't close to being there to pass anything through the Senate as far-reaching as Medicare for All or anything close to it. It will be a hard fight to get a public option because there are – still moderate to conservative Democrats like Kristen Sinema in Arizona,
right,
and Joe Manchin in West Virginia,
mm-hmm,
who are not going to want to go there. And therefore, to spend an entire campaign arguing over something that is not legislatively possible between 20 and 24 just seems a ludicrous exercise.
So why do we have to be reasonable, Walter? Let me, and I'm going to say this in a sort of obnoxious way. Donald Trump promised the sun, the moon, and the stars. The sun, the moon, and the stars, and then more. He's delivered on, but that's what he did. And people kind of like him because I like the idea that he's going to drain the swamp, he's upsetting the system, the wall, well, we're not really getting wall. Well, you know, we're getting deregulation, but oh, God, I'm dying because what they deregulated was now poison food. I mean, it's just the Republicans are absolutely fearless in literally going over the top. And the Democrats are told, be reasonable, be moderate,
count the noses,
count the votes. Well, you know what? At some point in time, maybe you need to have some balls.
Well, the flip side is, I'm sorry. We are talking at a moment where Donald Trump is about to be
impeached,
the third president in the United States history to be impeached.
Mm-hmm.
His approval rating, which should be based on prior presidents and this kind of unemployment rate in the low 60s is at 41-42% in
right,
the averages.
Right.
Throw in the mix that the only reason we're debating and we're about to pass an impeachment resolution is because Donald Trump and the Republicans were wiped out in the suburbs
in
the 2018
yeah,
election.
Right.
And let us just add that while 2019, there are too few races, and they were idiosyncratic to draw epic conclusions.
Right.
What happened in Kentucky, in the Kentucky suburbs of Cincinnati,
oh, yeah, with the governor.
What happened in Virginia,
yeah,
even in the suburbs of Richmond and Norfolk, indicates that thanks to Donald Trump, the Republicans have a massive suburban problem. So I don't buy the idea that this act is working. I buy the idea that this is a desperate, desperate juggling act,
mm-hmm,
with that is not going to stay in the air in November 2020.
So I sent you a note yesterday because one of my friends from New Hampshire made an announcement that he is endorsing Amy Klobuchar. And I thought it was really interesting because you said you've only seen her in Iowa. And this is someone who has seen virtually all the candidates in New Hampshire, many of them, as he says, several times. And he talks about the responsibility that he takes of making the endorsement. And he says, but today I'm excited to announce that I've decided to support Senator Amy Klobuchar. I've been looking for a candidate who has been a consistent progressive, who is smart and knowledgeable, who has an appreciation for what less advantaged Americans have to deal with, who's tough and poised, who has the political experience, track record, and biography to be a strong general election candidate. Given the importance of 2020, I want a candidate with a history of winning in more conservative counties and congressional districts. Though I appreciate the appeal of several of the other candidates, and though I work hard for whoever the nominee is, I feel that this candidate best meets my criteria, which is why he is endorsing Amy Klobuchar. And I thought this was kind of interesting. And you know what I think Amy Klobuchar's finest hour was? During the Supreme Court.
The Kavanaugh hearing.
I think she should play that all the time. I think there was a sense of dignity. There was a sense of authenticity. There was a level of authority there. And whether you think Kavanaugh was being railroaded or whether you think Kavanaugh should never been, ever been on any bench, what you had to really love is how he attacked her and how she responded. And that is a level of gravitas that I think many of us are yearning for. Policy is important, but the ability to respond like that, that is crucial, I think, with the kind of GOP that Donald Trump has turned it into.
Let me throw in one other thing here. Is in a world where I tend to believe that given the mess the next Democratic president is going to inherit,
yeah,
Washington experience is important.
Yeah.
That with the exception of Bernie Sanders, who plays, shall we say, a rather more of a gadfly in Congress, and of course Joe Biden, Klobuchar actually has the longest political resume since she was first elected to the Senate in 2006.
Wow.
And so it's...
She's not a child of the Senate, but she spent a lot of time in the Senate. She's done the heavy lift. I have a lot of friends out in the West Coast who've been trying to get me to sort of pay attention to Amy Klobuchar. I know a lot of liberals in Minnesota that are a little about Amy, and I get it. I get it. You know, she is not a Bernie. She is not a Paul Wellstone. She is not an Elizabeth.
By the way,
Warren.
She does invoke Paul Wellstone constantly.
Really?
As her model of a grassroots campaign.
Oh, well, Paul Wellstone.
Although she didn't support his progressive views by any
means. That's right.
But she supported him, and we've talked about him. And as she says, she claims that the green in her campaign colors
is from Paul.
Are an homage to his green bus, and also to green that Iowa Senator Tom Harkin used as his campaign color.
Well, last but not least, I'm going to end with this. So Paul Wellstone wins his race for the U.S. Senate in 1991. I get a phone call from Paul Wellstone. Arnie, you're running for governor, right? Yes, Paul. You want to borrow the bus? You want to borrow the bus. So I've always been from the Wellstone wing of the Democratic Party, and I appreciate that she values Paul Wellstone, not a lot of his agenda, but she values what he did in organizing the grassroots, which was really inspirational. And if she has more conversation with grassroots people, we'll see what happens. But it's going to be a very, very interesting debate tomorrow night. So I look forward to hearing from you, writing for something for New Republic. And then I'll pick your brain again, Walter Shapiro. Is that a deal?
Always a pleasure, Arnie.
It's always a pleasure, too. Take care. Thank you so much. And I can't wait for the 12th campaign that you cover. I know. Shut up,
Arnie. I hope it's a Democrats' reelection.
Yeah, you and me both. Okay, ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. What should we end with? I think we should end with... you know what? Let's end with think, because we've got the impeachment vote today. We've got the choice that we have to make on the 2020 campaign. We've got the debate. We need to think, and we need to not be ideologues, and we need to be somewhat practical. But let's also remember, we've elected a lot of people that claim to be practical, and I think they've delivered Donald Trump. I think a lot of the Democrats, you know, when it came to crime, when it came to inequity, when it came to what happened after the economic meltdown, they gave a moderate response. Guess what? Who was left out? The rest of us. And the 1% got it.
And that's what Warren stands for, by the way, is reversing that.
Reversing that. Here we go. Think with Aretha Franklin. Change.